Simple words on a page with pictures beside. This is all I have, this humble book. But oh, what words, what pictures, what a book. I am P.J. Lynch, Laureate Nanogue of Ireland, and you're listening to Night, Night, Northwest.
Hello to everyone here and to all our listeners at home. You're all very welcome to Twin Towns Community Library in County Donegal for the seventh programme in our series called Night Night Northwest. Over the course of this radio series, we will bring you 14 unique programmes, all based on Irish children's literature. You will hear stories about a snobby cat, a dreaming tree, a little bear who just can't sleep, and Daddy Nut Brown Hair who says, "Guess how much I love you." We are delighted to be joined today by the pupils from St. Mary's National School's Stranoller 6th class. Our guest reader, Tricia Keane, is an All-Ireland award-winning actress. Tricia will be reading an abridged version of The Boy Who Fell Off the Mayflower, written and illustrated by the Laureate Nanogue, P.J. Lynch. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
This is Tricia.
Morning,
everyone.
Doing?
What class are you?
Sixth class.
So I'm going to read you the back of the book first, okay? So the mate and his crew were hard at work fighting the weather. Sometimes it was so bad that they had to let the ship lie under the bare poles, point her into the wind and hope that she would weather the storm. It was just such a time when I took myself to go up onto the deck, despite the orders that we were all to stay below. I was seeking a bit of relief from the foul stench between the decks. I was hardly up through the hatch when a huge wave hit and sent me flying over the side. Were any of you on the ship? One, two, three. So we're all going to have an experience now of what it's going to be like on a ship. But a ship when things were very, very hard. So will I start? The Boy Who Fell Off the Mayflower by P.J. Lynch. London. London was a fine city when I was there. Greatest city in the whole world. It smelt bad, I must say. But it was huge and busy and exciting for a young lad like me. It was all because of the king that we had to leave England. Him and his bishops didn't like the way our people chose to worship. We came to London to rent ourselves a ship with a certain Captain Jones and his crew. We were loading her up with provisions for the long voyage to America. When I wasn't running all around London ordering barrels of this and that, my master John Carver had me copying out lists of supplies and letters to the businessmen who were lending us money to fund our voyage. When our ships was nearly loaded, Master Carver sent me to find the Warwick Inn, up by the city wall beyond the cathedral. I was looking for a certain gentleman. In the noisy throng of the Londoners, a tall, white-bearded man stood out, Elder William Brewster. I whispered to him, "Master Carver sent me for you." We stuck to the back lanes and alleyways, and by the time we made it down to the wharf, it was already dark. At last, we came to our ship. She was been loaded by lamplight now. Casks of beer, sacks of onions and cabbage, and boxes of salty herring, and barrels of corned beef. Tasty stuff. My master shook William Brewster's hand fit to shake it off. Then he hurriedly guided us across the gangway. "Thank the Lord you are safe, William," he said. "Welcome on board the Mayflower." I rang up on the deck for one last look at London. Only a few lights were lit, and the big ship made hardly a sound, drifting down on the tide away from the sleeping city. William Bradford, Captain Standish, and the other important folks gathered round my master. I went to chat with the other servants. The lads were all excited about our venture ahead of us. "I hear that the trees here are 5 times bigger than in England," said Bill Booten, the doctor's servant, "and the rivers are full to the brim with fat fish just begging to get caught." "Now there's a fine young lady. Might make a good wife for me in a year or three, said Bill. And he nodded towards a skinny girl who was playing nearby with the little ones. Master Tilly will have your hide if you go near his Lizzie, said Roger. When she comes of age, she'll be wanting to marry the doctor, not the doctor's skivvy. So we committed ourselves to the will of God and put to sea at last under the prosperous wind, all of us on one good ship. Bob Copen barked his orders and the sailor boys were busy shining up the rigging and unfurling the sails. The wind snapped the canvas taut and the old ship timbers creaked as she smartly went through the waves. Many's a tear that was shed as we waved farewell to our friends, to Plymouth and to England. Our time at sea was tedious and uncomfortable. As servants, we at least had a few jobs to keep us busy. As we sailed on, we encountered fierce storms, and we didn't get up to see the sky for days on end. Each big wave that broke over the ship rained down through the decks on top of us. In spite of it all, Lizzie Tilly remained cheerful, and she and the other girls played games with the little ones to keep their spirits up. It was just such a time when I took it upon myself to go up on deck, despite the order that we were all to stay below. I was seeking a bit of relief from the foul stench tween decks. I was hardly up through the hatch when a huge wave hit and sent me flying over the side. Down and down I went into the darkness under the icy waves. It was quiet down there, no raging wind or rain like up above. A strong current was dragging me deeper and further away from the ship. The deeper it got, the darker it got, and soon I wasn't feeling the cold. I just wanted to shut my eyes and go to sleep for 100 years. Wake up, John, said my mother's voice. Wake up, dreamer. Far up above, I saw the Mayflower's keel. I thought, that's my ship. She's taking me to America. Suddenly, a flash of lightning lit up a long rope trailing down from the ship. I pulled myself towards it. My lungs were bursting now, but I caught hold of the rope and held on tight in the freezing water. Luckily for me, one of the crew had seen me fall overboard. Bob and his sailor boys hauled me in like a big fish. They were shouting and scolding me and rolling me over a barrel to get the seawater out of my lungs. I have had no recollection at all of what happened after that or over the next few days. But Roger told me that my master had me brought to his cabin and Mistress Carver herself nursed me until I was well. It was a week before I was on my feet again, and the first day I went back among the passengers, I noticed a great alteration in them. 2 months lying wet and weary in the unwholesome old ship was taking their toll. Folks were glad to see that I was all right, and they clapped me on the back, and some of them couldn't even rise in their bunks. The pain in their joints were that bad. When old Master Chilton joked about me trying to swim home to England, his laugh turned into a wheezy cough, and I saw that his gums were all rancid and black. Then Bill Booten took a fever on the third day, and he died. Not a thing his master, the doctor, could do about it. As Bill's shrouded body was pitched into the sea, I saw Lizzie Tilly and some of the younger ones crying. I wondered if she might have cried if that were me. One morning in early November, the shout went up, "Land, hoy!" Those that were able rushed up on deck to see what America looked like. It didn't look like much to have crossed a vast ocean and a sea of troubles for. A grey stretch of sandy cliffs and a few scubby trees. But all of us passengers were right joyous, thinking that soon our feet would be on dry land again. Our first duty, John, said Master Carver, turning to me. Get out your ink and your quill. We have a new charter for you to copy out in your best hand. Now, young Master Howland, William Bradford said, throwing me a sword and scabbard. Arm yourself well. We're going ashore. As soon as we set foot on dry land, we fell on our knees and blessed the God of heaven who had brought us over the vast and furious ocean and delivered us from our peril. I confess that while the others were praying, I was keeping a sharp eye out for any more pearls that might be lurking in the shrub. We began to explore and we found the place to be naked and a barren wilderness. Our search of the area revealed no suitable place for habitation, nor do we know how to find or meet the native people we knew that inhabited this land. We did find some houses seemingly abandoned though, and under a mound of sand, we dug up a great basket filled with seed corn. After the long tedium of the voyage, we were all busy now about the ship and on the shore. Our people ferried back and forth to refresh themselves on dry land and returned to the ship with firewood and fresh water. But the corn that we took, well, that seemed a lot like stealing to me. Truth is, we were getting desperate, not only for food, but for a place to settle. And each day that passed, more of our people on board the Mayflower fell ill. In the morning, one of our company ran screaming, "Indians! Indians!" And straight away, a hail of arrows came zipping all around us. We rushed to our muskets and fired back. We could see the Indians' leader fiercely letting fly his arrows from behind a tree, only half a musket shot away from us. Captain Stanish finally hit the tree itself, and the Indian took flight with a great cry, and the rest of his band behind him. We collected ourselves, loaded into the scallop right quick, and cast off, heading north along the coast. We sailed with the icy winds whipping around us all that day without seeing a harbour, a river or a creek. The wind behind us now was so strong that our mast shattered. And with our rudder hanging loose, the shallop was tossed like a toy from one huge breaker to the next. It was only by God's mercy that our boat was borne into the shelter of a small island rather than been broken into pieces on the rocky shore. Turned out it wasn't the place Bob had thought, but when we had a chance to sound the harbour and survey the land around it, we agreed that this was indeed the most hopeful place for our settlement. Lizzie and the women were up before dawn, boiling dried peas for pottage, and those that were poorly ate little or nothing. Most of her time was spent cleaning the sick and washing their filthy bedding. I helped with Lizzie's father and her uncle, and then with Roger. The work was so lonesome that I thought it was a blessing to be ordered out into the cold and rain to fell trees and split planks. A few of the sick, like William Bradford, recovered, but in spite of all the care that young Lizzie Tilly gave her family, they all died, one after the other, mother, father, aunt and uncle. We buried our dead at night so the Indians might not see our true weakness. Our great adventure in the New World was becoming a nightmare of sickness, death and danger. By the time the winter was over, Roger had died, and so had most of the other servant lads too. Of 100 and odd persons, scarce 50 of us were left.
You want to see some of the pictures? So this book was illustrated and written by the same man, P.J. Lynch.
So look at London then. It really looks different, doesn't it, with all the different roofs and everything.
Kira, what do you think of the pictures? Do you like them?
Yeah.
They're really nice, aren't they?
Do you think they depict what Tricia was reading?
No.
No?
No?
Is it different to how you thought?
I thought it would be like London now, not like that.
London then? Yeah, it's like, way back, isn't it?
This story was written a long time ago when a ship called the Mayflower was sailing to America.
Look at the costumes. So that tells you how old it is.
Sarah, who's this?
It's the girl in the dress playing with the kids. It's Lizzie.
Do you remember her name?
Lizzie.
Tilly.
Tilly.
I think that's a great name, isn't it? I think she's funny. But so, I think she could be about your age minding all these little ones.
What about Sean?
Good book. I like it.
Yeah?
Seems a bit good so far. Interesting.
Good. So what was the name of the ship?
Ostea.
Mayflower.
The Mayflower. So this is sixth class. So you're all 12, 13 probably, yeah? 12? So in these days, young kids like you used to head off in these big ships and go to America on their own. Can you imagine? Would you fancy that? No Netflix, no Wi-Fi, no phones.
Huh? Okay, will we carry on? Are you all ready?
Will we see what happens?
With the arrival of spring, the bitterness had gone from the north wind, and we had fewer sick folk and more houses to build. One morning, a tall, fine-looking Indian walked boldly into our village. He walked right up to Captain Stanish and said, "Welcome, Englishman." He told us about the mighty Sachem who ruled the land and the great King Massiote and of his many warriors. It was arranged that Massiote himself should come to our settlement and we welcomed him as royalty. After much discussion, Governor Carver and Massiote made the solemn peace treaty between our people. They had embraced and exchanged gifts as if they were old friends. On one fine day, not a month after the ship had left, Master Carver himself took ill while he was out working in the fields, and within a few days he died. He'd been our leader and our governor, and he had been a very good master to me. He even left me a sum of money in his will. His death was much lamented, and we buried him in the best manner we could with some volleys of shots from all those with muskets. Now I was left without a master. I was a free and equal man. I was working on the roof of the house of Dr. Fuller when Captain Standish shouted from the fort, "Ship ahoy!" This was the first ship in our harbour since the Mayflower had anchored there a full year before. She was called the Fortune. We had hoped for supplies from England, but all we got were 35 new settlers without so much as a biscuit cake. The ship's master wanted to be off again smartly, so we loaded in the salted fish and two hogsheads of beaver pelt. This was valuable cargo that would go a long way towards paying our debts to our bankers. I thought hard on things. I was a free man with money in my purse, and here was the Fortune that was about to return to London. London, where a hard-working young man might make something of himself, and where I might see my family and hear my mother's gentle voice. I resolved to take my passage home. My friends all came to say farewell. They were sad to see me go, but they didn't try to stop me. Lizzie Tilly came too. "I hear you're going back to London, John Howland." "You should come back too, Lizzie. You have no kin here. There is only another hard and hungry winter ahead of you. My family is here, buried here, planted in American soil," said Lizzie, trying to control her temper. "They wanted to build something good here, and they died trying. They shall not have died in vain, Master Howland. You go back to England. I am not leaving." With that, she turned and walked away from me. I thought hard on it again. I thought about London. I thought about Mr. Carver and Roger and Massiote and all my friends and what we had been through together. I thought of the rope lit up by the lightning and the darkness under the icy waves. Why was I saved? To go back to London and make myself a fortune? Or to stay here and help put a roof on Dr. Fuller's house and maybe to help build something bigger, something better? I thought again about my family. Most of all, though, I thought about Lizzie Tilly. I turned my back on the Fortune, and I went up the hill to Dr. Fuller's house, and I picked up my hammer. Now, this is the author's note at the back. It was fortunate for John Howland that he didn't try to return to England on the Fortune. On the voyage home, she and her valuable cargo were taken by French pirates. John never did return to England, and he never saw his mother again. But a few years later, his brothers, Arthur and Henry, followed him across the Atlantic to Plymouth and settled close by him. A year or two after the events described in this book, John Howland and Elizabeth Tilley were married. They lived together for over 50 years until John died in 1672 or 1673. Elizabeth lived on for 15 more years. It seemed they had a loving marriage, and it was certainly a fruitful one. They had 10 children and 88 grandchildren. The peace between the Wampanoag and the English settlers endured throughout John Howland's long life. Now, so, did it turn out like you thought? No? Why not? Why is that, Riona?
Because I thought that John might have went back to England.
Yeah. Why did he stay?
Because he wanted to get married to Lizzie Tilley.
Why else?
He wanted to help out build his doctor's house.
Yeah, I think he did. Connor?
You thought he was going to go back to England because that's where his mother is.
He missed his mother. Did he ever see his mother again?
No.
Never. Ever again.
I thought that he was going to go home and then Lizzie was going to die then.
Oh, I know.
What happened here? That was sad, wasn't it? What, Riona?
It was the burial of Lizzie Tilley's relatives.
Yeah. Is that the end bit where she's given out to him? Yeah. Why was she given out to him? Sarah?
Because he wanted her to go with him and she didn't want to leave the place where her family was buried.
And didn't she try to make him stay to build the houses?
Yeah.
But why did she really? I think she was secretly in love with him, was she? Did you like it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you guys like it? Yeah? Good.
Simple words on a page with pictures beside. This is all I have, this humble book. But oh, what words, what pictures, what a book. I am PJ Lynch, Laureate Nanogue of Ireland, and you're listening to Night, Night, Northwest.
That's it from this episode of the series. I'd like to thank the children from St. Mary's National School. Please join us next week when we will be broadcasting from Carndonagh Community Library, and our audience will be children from Doonagh National School. So until next week...
The Boy Who Fell Off the Mayflower, or John Howland's Good Fortune, read by Tricia Keane, written and illustrated by PJ Lynch, first published in 2015 by Walker Books. Night Night Northwest Series 2 was written, produced, directed and presented by Alison Toomey, with sound recordist Mary Harkin and editor Orla Malone. A Real Films production, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee, along with the Donegal County Council Library Service and Creative Ireland.